temporary stuff, right? But today's talk looks back a little bit at a case that I understand from some of my colleagues at the law school is quite infamous. So the talk today is the case of Colonel Abel, what the prosecution of a master Soviet spy teaches about American and Russian criminal justice. So thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very glad to be here. And also thanks to Dr. Tischler for the poster. I looked at it on the computer and I saw this picture and my name under it, and I'm looking at it and I thought, well, I'm thin, but I'm not that thin. And I looked at it a little closer and then I realized it was Colonel Abel. So I just want to make clear that, and for the record, I'm not now nor ever have been a member of the Communist Party. And with that, we can proceed. This past June, 10 men and women were arrested on suspicion of being deep cover illegal Russian spies in the United States. And they were quickly arraigned in federal court, where they negotiated plea bargains and were traded for real or imagined American spies languishing in American in Russian prisons. In seeking to convey the magnitude of the event, the Associated Press journalists who broke the story wrote in the first paragraphs of their articles that this blockbuster series of arrests, as they described it, might even be as significant as the FBI's, quote, famous capture of Soviet Colonel Rudolf Abel in 1957 in New York. To many Americans, that name might not have meant very much, and of course, Rudolf Ivanovich Abel was an alias, like many other names he used. Colonel Abel was the KGB intelligence officer who secretly entered the United States to take charge of all Soviet espionage in North America for almost a decade during the height of the Red Scare and the start of the Cold War. The irony is that Colonel Abel's arrest and trial had virtually nothing in common with the experience of these more recent spies. Abel was detained by methods that are hard to distinguish from the extrajudicial detentions that followed after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He was then tried by a jury in federal court for military and atomic espionage, offenses that carried the death penalty. He was convicted and appealed his case all the way to the United States Supreme Court, which found his case so difficult that it ordered two separate rounds of oral argument, a highly unusual event for such a highly unusual case. His lawyer managed to save Abel's life. Instead of dying in the electric chair, he spent 4 years in a federal prison before he was traded for the captured U-2 pilot Francis Gary Powers in an exchange one cold morning in 1962 on the middle of the Gleinecke Bridge that connects Potsdam with Berlin. So although both Abel and these recent spies share the common experience 50 years apart of having been arrested during the month of June, the similarities end there. But what good fortune for us that Abel's name should have returned to the front pages of our newspapers. Because his case presents issues that shed light both on the Russian system of criminal justice and on our own. A theme running throughout the newspaper coverage of Abel's trial, and it was in the news every day, was that Abel would receive a fairer trial in the United States than any captured American spy could hope to receive in the Soviet Union. Well, more interesting for us today, perhaps, is what Colonel Abel's trial would have looked like if it were tried in Russia today under the new Russian Criminal Procedure Code. Through Abel's story, that's the question I want to examine. I want to weave together two separate but related strands of comparison. Abel's case as tried in an American and in a hypothetical Russian courtroom, and second, the lessons an older era of fear can teach for our current one. The comparison is worth making. First, courts in both Russia and the United States now have terrorism cases on their dockets. But both countries have expressed reluctance to conduct these cases according to the normal criminal procedures. Ideologically driven, international terrorists are today's nearest analog to communist agents in the atmosphere of hyperfear that was still palpable in the shadow of the McCarthy era. And as an aside, I was delighted to learn the other night that McCarthy graduated from Marquette Law School, not from Wisconsin Law School. Second, the Russian criminal justice system is still in its early years as a newly adversarial system of justice. The Russian Federation, as I said, adopted a radically new code that went into effect only in 2002. 50 years ago, at the time of Abel's trial, the American system of justice was, well, not new, but it certainly was in flux. It was adapting to what some have called the revolution in criminal procedure conducted by the United States Supreme Court under Chief Justice Earl Warren. So in the next 45 minutes, I will tell you a little bit about Polkovnik Abel Rudolf Ivanovich, a.k.a. Mark, Colonel Mark, Andrew Kayadis, Emil Goldfuss, Martin Collins, William Fisher, and my favorite, Willie the Wisp. I'll describe his arrest and his trial, and I'll compare his experience of American justice with what he could expect to experience today in the Russian criminal justice system. In particular, I want to focus on three topics: Abel's arrest, the appointment of counsel to represent him, and the work of that attorney before and during Abel's trial. And perhaps this comparison may be of help to you if you are considering a career in illegal espionage. But I think it also presents a story that is full of both honor and error, and one that contains some important lessons. So first, who was Colonel Abel? Even the most basic details of his life as a Soviet spy are shrouded in obscurity, but this much we know. He was born in 1903 as William August Fisher in what was then the outskirts of the city of Newcastle-on-Tyne in northern England. He was a son of Heinrich Fischer, a well-educated metalworker born in Russia of German ancestry, who would later flee Tsarist Russia to found the Newcastle branch of the Russian Social Democratic Workers' Party. And he assisted in the publication and distribution of Iskra when Vladimir Lenin was quartered in London. As a teenager, Abel moved from England to Moscow, where his father took a short turn on the Comintern's UK desk before Lenin's death made the life of an old Bolshevik a rather precarious one. Abel married, and the couple was blessed with a daughter. Now, Abel's British citizenship meant a legitimate Western European passport. His Newcastle upbringing meant English fluency. His wife and child in Moscow were excellent insurance against defection, and this, plus his workers' credentials and his internationalist upbringing, were, to quote Humphrey Bogart quoting Shakespeare, the stuff that dreams are made of, especially if the dreamer happened to be a recruiter for the Soviet clandestine services. So after surviving the Stalinist purges, and with a distinguished record in World War II, no mean feat, either one, Abel became an illegal KGB officer, that is, one who's formally unassociated with the Soviet embassy or some other official mission, and he was active in Oslo and then in London before he took charge of all Soviet espionage in North America in 1946. That all came crashing down on June 21st, 1957, almost exactly 53 years before these recent arrests. Early that midsummer morning, two special agents of the FBI, in the words of their affidavit, pushed their way into room 839 at the Hotel Latham in Manhattan. They found there a sleepy and half-naked Abel, whom they sat upright on his bed. The agents identified themselves as charged with investigating matters of internal security, and they questioned him for 20 minutes, insinuating knowledge of his espionage activities by addressing him as Colonel. The FBI agents told Abel that, quote, if he did not cooperate, he would be arrested before he left the room. When Abel refused, the FBI walked out, and the INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, then a part of the Department of Justice, walked in. Under the close observation of the FBI agents waiting at the door, the INS arrested Abel, searched him, the contents of the room, and seized several items as evidence of Abel's alienage. Immediately after Abel had checked out of the hotel, with the permission of the hotel manager, the FBI now went back up to the hotel room and searched it themselves, where they found a cipher pad, a hollowed out pencil, microfilm, all sorts of evidence that was used to convict him at his trial. Now, how did the FBI know that Abel was in this particular hotel room, let alone a colonel of the KGB? They owed their information to a drunk and dissolute junior spy named Reino Heihinen, Abel's incompetent subordinate. Heihinen had secretly defected and told the FBI everything he knew about Abel, which wasn't very much because Abel was such a good spy that he hadn't told Heihinen very much. But he did know enough about Abel to track down his Brooklyn loft. Heihinen offered as proof of his bona fides a nickel that was nearly identical to one that Heihinen had lost years before by giving it to a newsboy in exchange for a newspaper. But this nickel was hollow, and when the newsboy dropped it on the ground, it opened up to reveal microfilm. The nickel and microfilm found its way to the FBI, which began an investigation. although J. Edgar Hoover at the time wasn't interested in giving too much time to it. It was the bringing of the second nickel by Hayhinen that convinced the FBI that this was a serious matter. So here the story gets interesting. Although they had sufficient information to do so, neither the FBI nor the INS sought a warrant signed by a federal judge or a United States commissioner to arrest him or to search his room. That's required by the United States Constitution. Instead, the government used a pretext. The immigration agents obtained an administrative order signed by another Justice Department official granting them authority to detain Abel on a suspected immigration violation. The commissioner of immigration at the time told reporters, quote, "We were well aware of what he was when we picked him up. Our idea at the time was to hold him as long as we could. No arrest warrant meant no arraignment in court, and that meant no press. The government could make Abel vanish into thin air, and nobody would ever know." And that's exactly what happened. A few hours later, Abel was secretly bustled onto a special plane waiting for him in Newark and flown 13 hours to a federal detention center in McAllen, Texas. He was held there for almost 7 weeks. During this time, the FBI questioned him in lengthy interrogation sessions and without a lawyer, hoping to turn him into a double agent or at least obtain intelligence about Soviet espionage. But Colonel Abel was a well-trained spy, and he met threats and promises with almost complete and total silence. The FBI finally gave up and decided to hold a deportation proceeding for which Abel was granted a lawyer. He was found deportable, but he wasn't deported. Instead, he was returned to New York to face capital charges of military and atomic espionage. Only with the announcement of his indictment did his forced disappearance come to an end. Now, Abel had been held by federal agents in solitary confinement and in total secrecy for 48 days, 2,000 miles from the place of arrest, and without having appeared before any judicial officer for any reason. The resonance between Abel's treatment and the seizure and extrajudicial detention of suspected terrorists in the years after September 11th is pretty striking. Now, if we assume compliance with the Russian Federation Constitution and Code of Criminal Procedure, and I am aware that this is not a small assumption, Abel's extrajudicial seizure and detention by the FBI could not be duplicated in Russia. Article 22 of the Russian Constitution provides that all forms of arrest and detention shall be permissible only under a court order, and that detention may not last for more than 48 hours without a court order. You will not find such detail in the U.S. Constitution. The requirements give an even more precise explanation in the new Criminal Procedure Code. What's more, the Russian Constitution expressly provides for the right to counsel. The Criminal Procedure Code provides that the right to counsel attaches at various specific points, but most importantly, quote, "from the point in time when any other coercive procedural actions or other procedural actions are taken that infringe on the rights and freedoms of a suspect." That is to guard against the tactical manipulation of formal decision-making. Had such rules been applied to Abel's case in America, he could not have been interrogated for 7 weeks in Texas. In Russia, the constitutional right to counsel expressly includes free legal assistance for those in need from the moment that the person is detained. And by federal law in Russia, members of the bar are required to provide pro bono legal services to indigent members of society, not only in criminal cases, but also in certain civil matters. By comparison, although lawyers in the United States are encouraged to offer free legal services to the poor, our Constitution and statutes say nothing about it, and no law requires it. The right of indigent defendants to free legal counsel comes relatively late in American legal history, and debate about the point about when the right attaches continued at least through the mid-1980s. Here, however, American function outpaces Russian form. How legal protection is given practical realization to the most unpopular or impoverished, I think, is probably the proper measure of its strength for everybody. In America, state and federal systems provide for public defenders who are paid salaries by the state that, although relatively low, are adequate to provide a living. In addition, the system of salaried public defenders, in addition to that, a federal statute also provides for the appointment of private counsel who are typically paid $60 an hour in federal court and $40 an hour for time reasonably expended outside of court. In Russia, the sums are far lower, on average $15 to $20 a day, and payable only for time spent in court. And that's a crucial difference. When one considers the importance of a pretrial investigation and legal research, the disparity in fees is compounded by these limits on what's a compensable lawyerly activity. Had Abel been an American spy on trial in Russia, he likely would have needed a public defender. This system would have encouraged his lawyer to do virtually no outside legal research or investigation. The pay is only for what the lawyer does in court. But as any good lawyer will tell you, it's what happens outside of the courtroom that's most important of all. And Abel had a very good lawyer. At Abel's request, the judge in his case sought the recommendation of a local bar, which nominated a man named James Britt Donovan to represent him. Donovan was 41 years old. He was a Harvard-educated New York City lawyer, former Nuremberg prosecutor, and general counsel to what was known during World War II as the OSS. But he was no relation to the founder of that organization, Wild Bill Donovan. Donovan's decision to accept Abel as a client was not one he could take very lightly. First of all, the case would likely take a considerable amount of time. As it turns out, it was an obligation that lasted almost 4.5 years. During this time, he zealously represented Abel's interests until the day they parted on the Glinica Bridge. Second, the notoriety of such an unpopular client in McCarthy-era America could destroy a lawyer's reputation and sink his legal practice. This was not an easy case to live down when he ran and lost for election to the U.S. Senate against Jacob Javits. Third, Donovan was convinced of Abel's guilt. Why, then, did Donovan accept the appointment? He was following in an honorable tradition that American lawyers zealously defend the interests of their clients, no matter how infamous or unpopular. And that tradition is older than the U.S. Constitution. You just should think of John Adams' defense of the soldiers involved in the Boston Massacre. In Russia, the Soviet past remains fresh, which underscores the need for private counsel, independent of state control. But here's another important difference that highlights another issue of legal reform in Russia. Americans have tended to focus on their advocates, maybe naively assuming that a court's neutrality could be expected. Even in a case as politically sensitive as Abel's, there was never a question about the impartiality and integrity of the judge who was randomly assigned to preside over the case. But in Russia, one thinks as much of the need for independent judges as one does of the need for zealous lawyers. And here the tradition is not one of pride, but one of constant concern that extends way back before the Soviet Union to the Russian Empire. I have in mind, for example, Anatoly Kony, the exception that is often offered to prove this rule. Kony was an honest judge who chaired the trial court in St. Petersburg in 1878 in a case in which the defendant was named Vera Zasulich. Vera Zasulich had shot at point-blank range the military governor of St. Petersburg. She shot him because he had ordered the flogging of a fellow student, and she was outraged by the brutality of that order. The Russian government was at the time fighting and losing the Russo-Turkish War, and public opinion in St. Petersburg was on a razor's edge. So the idea was it was safer for the Russian government to have a jury trial convict Vera Zasulich of this obvious crime than to have a conviction at the hands of a trial judge. And there were juries in Imperial Russia. But just to be on the safe side, the Minister of Justice went to Kony to order the conviction. Kony told him, "All I can offer is impartiality and a fair trial." This enraged Paulin, because the Minister of Justice, because it was his head on the line as much as anybody else's, and sure enough, the jury acquitted Vera Zasulich, saying that she was not guilty of the acts even though she had done them. Paulin's words to Kony were, "The state has a right to expect special services from the court and from you. There are cases which must be viewed politically." Now, although these words were uttered more than 130 years ago, the principle and the pressure and the individual courage required of lawyers and judges remains the same in Russia today. Last week, Amnesty International reported on a lawyer in southern Russia who was beaten by police for seeking access to her client. Then she was put under house arrest and charged with insulting the integrity of law enforcement officials. Her client was an unexceptional one. Lawyers for controversial defendants have suffered far worse retaliation and in some cases death while in the custody of the state. And nor have judges escaped controversy or retaliation for independence or opposition to corruption. Of course, this isn't a distinctively Russian problem, but it's apparent that it's a lesson that must repeatedly be relearned. Appointed to defend Abel, Donovan went to work. And here I have to pause for a few minutes just to make some clarifying remarks about an essential difference between two classical systems of criminal justice. The system of justice with which you might be most familiar is our own. It's what's called an adversarial system. Its essential premise is that evidence, whether in the form of statements or physical evidence, is only admissible at trial through the testimony of live witnesses. The adversaries in the trial are expected to conduct separate, independent investigations. Only in limited circumstances are the two sides expected to disclose their files to one another. And typically, it's the defendant who benefits from such sharing, which is meant to balance the state's greater power to gather evidence. Neither side is entirely trusted to present an unbiased presentation. It's thought that through the power of cross-examination, attorneys will reveal the weaknesses of the other side, and then a jury can evaluate the strength of the evidence and the credibility of the witnesses. And if you think about it, every year there's always a movie about some big trial, and the climax of the movie always comes in the courtroom. And the courtroom is really nothing more than a theater stage. So you've got the judge, you've got the jury box, you've got counsel's tables, a witness stand, a court reporter. And if you look at the vectors of attention for the geography of an adversarially organized courtroom, they're all pointing to the stage. So not surprising that there's a certain drama to the American trial. Keep that thought in mind as I describe Donovan's work. It was a perfect example of the adversarial approach. Donovan immediately hired a private investigator to search for evidence that could be used to impeach the credibility of the state's star witness, the defector, Reino Heihinen, Abel's former incompetent subordinate. And Donovan may have been the first lawyer in the country to make use of a new federal statute, the Jenks Act, which had come into force about 2 weeks before the trial. This law required the state to turn over summaries of Heihinen's debriefing sessions with the FBI to obtain the basic raw material of what the man said before it was processed through the direct examination. And even the modest release that the court granted Donovan proved the value of such information. One prior statement, written and signed by Heihinen, directly contradicted his testimony that he had engaged in espionage at Abel's direction. So now Donovan could ask the classic question of cross-examination. Were you lying then, or are you lying now? Finally, Donovan was as much a master of bluntly worded objections that interrupted his opponent's examination of witnesses as he was a cutting master of cross-examination, which Donovan wielded like a scalpel. The direct testimony of the state star witness was pockmarked with Donovan's voiced objections to the leading form of questions asked by the prosecution, the relevance of the issues raised in the direct examination, and the competence of the witness to answer them. And these all illustrate a crucial difference between the oral focus of an American criminal trial and the largely written focus, then and now, of a Russian one that I'll describe in a moment. It also illustrates the great trust that's placed in juries in the American system, since more often than not, the judge responded to those objections by just noting it's for the jury to say whether or not they consider it of any weight and credibility as a matter of evidence. Donovan's closing argument explicitly made the comparison between the two systems of justice, but with the natural bias of an American lawyer for his own system. Here's how he addressed the jury. "We believe that our trial by jury system is the best system ever devised for arriving at the truth. Why is your function so important? You might say to yourselves, His Honor the judge knows all the law applicable to the case. He has been trained for many years to evaluate evidence. Why then shouldn't cases such as this simply be left to the lawyers and the judges? The answer is that from the time of Aristotle, many centuries ago, ordinary citizens are not content to leave these questions to the lawyers and judges with their legalisms and their legal niceties. These sharp exchanges, although they're a bit on the extreme side, highlight elements of the Anglo-American adversarial trial that may be contrasted with the classical continental European system, which goes by the unfairly sinister name of the inquisitorial system. It's the inquisitorial system that has had historically the greatest influence on Russia. The premise of that alternative system is not that all evidence must be presented orally in open court. In that system, the premise is, quod non est in actis, non est in mundo. What is not in the case file is not in the world. The file, or the case file, or the dossier, is a written collection of evidence compiled by an official state investigator. Unlike the adversarial system, which seeks only to evaluate competing claims of truth separately presented by biased parties, the inquisitorial system seeks to uncover the objective and complete truth of the crime. Only a neutral state investigator, tasked to uncover all evidence, inculpatory and exculpatory, can be trusted with such a function. His or her carefully compiled, technical and dry case file is the central object of the trial, not the drama and theater of competing live witnesses, as in this case. So here is a diagram of a typical Russian courtroom that I've seen, even one retrofitted with a jury box. You've still got the judge. You will have a place for the prisoner to sit behind bars. You'll have a jury box. There'll be maybe a table here, a chair for counsel here, a chair for counsel there, a stand for the witness. And look at the vectors of this sort of a case. Here's a judge. Everything is going here. Sometimes even the defendant will talk. And the jury sits and watches. Not like some drama, but an exchange between the judge, who in a classically inquisitorial system is more or less the verifier of the integrity of the investigation that has now been completed and put into a file. That's why you don't see a lot of Russian movies involving the drama of the courtroom. So far, we've got 12 Angry Men translated into Russia, but that all happens in the jury's deliberation room. Now that I've given you these two archetypes, neither of which truly exists, let me complicate the picture for you. Which one describes Russia today? The Russian criminal justice system is both the adversarial system and the inquisitorial system. On the one hand, the Constitution and the Code of Criminal Procedure describe Russia as operating an adversarial system of justice. Juries, the hallmark of an adversarial system, have returned to Russia after their long absence during the Soviet era. And the state's investigator is now recognized as a partisan figure on the side of the state's prosecutor. The defense is now given broader rights of pretrial investigation to prepare for trial in ways that would have been akin to obstruction of justice in Soviet times. On the other hand, the case file has not been abolished, and it still possesses such a gravitational weight that the trial, even jury trials, can still wind up revolving around it. As I mentioned before, pro bono counsel are paid only for their time in court, which discourages them from conducting pretrial investigations of their own. So even the intrepid public defender is going to find that most such investigation is still filtered through the person of the state's investigator. Notwithstanding the code's requirements of directness and orality, hallmarks of the adversarial approach, the people identified in these reports will not be required to appear at trial to subject their findings to the cross-examination of defense counsel. Even the testimony of witnesses can be read from the case file instead of heard from live persons in exceptional circumstances, and some courts have become quite adept at finding exceptional circumstances. The protocol, which is a non-verbatim summary of witness testimony given outside of court to the state's investigator, usually without the defense counsel present, would never be admissible in an American courtroom for anything other than impeachment purposes. But it's a core feature of the Russian case file, which fits oddly, if it does at all, with the newly readopted jury system and the retasked roles of investigator and prosecutor and defense counsel in what the Constitution and Code insist is an adversarial system. Since the defense's materials are produced only at trial, either as live testimony or as admitted evidence, the case file still retains a certain permanence, an aura of authenticity by virtue of its official status and its bound physicality. I'll never forget how my jaw dropped when I was working with the Department of Justice. I walked into a judge's chambers and saw stacked on a table a whole bunch of case files. And I asked, what are those? He said, those are the case files of the cases that I'm scheduled to hear in the next few weeks. In other words, he could read the case file compiled by the state's investigator before the defense counsel ever got into the room. So although the Russian Criminal Procedure Code has had the general effect of moving Russian trial practice more towards the adversarial end of the spectrum, it's the retention of this case file, an official record of investigation conducted by a state official during a pretrial investigation closed to the public, and frequently to the defense counsel, that remains a primary distinguishing feature between the two systems. Were Abel's case conducted in a Russian courtroom today, much of his lawyer's work would be very different. First, in all likelihood, Abel would have been denied a jury trial. The jury slowly returned in 1993, and it's now present in all but one region of Russia. But in 2008, under pressure from the security services, national security cases were exempted from the ordinary right of a defendant to a trial by jury. And the respected Russian lawyer Genry Reznik compared this retrenchment to the similar set of restrictions on the jury that the Imperial State Duma enacted after the jury acquitted Vera Zasulich. Second, considerably more time would be spent in attempts to influence the composition of the case file, that is, to influence the development of the prosecution's side of the case, in addition to the defense's own investigation. And great caution has to be exercised by defense counsel in deciding whether to use her new powers to make motions to compel investigative actions that might result in favorable evidence. After all of these actions are conducted, undertaken by the government's, that is, the prosecutor's criminal investigator. Now, in the United States, many call for special courts to try suspected terrorists, while others prefer military commissions, or simply opt not to try such individuals at all in order to extract intelligence without the limitations placed on government conduct by the constitutional guarantees that apply to criminal trials. And these terrorism cases have led to some controversial shifts toward a more inquisitorial approach to these rules of evidence in cases in federal courts evaluating the claims of detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Now, those cases are civil cases. They're cases of writs of habeas corpus that are presented in district court, and so the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment wouldn't apply. But the rules of evidence that are being invented to deal with what are considered the emergency or extreme situations brought about by the nature of the capture of these detainees are increasingly inquisitorial. Like the United States, Russia also feels compelled by the threat of terrorism to exempt certain crimes from normal criminal procedures. It's worth recalling just how similar were the fears of Abel's time. Less than a fortnight before his trial began, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik. And the federal prosecutor closed the government's case by describing Abel's offense as directed, quote, directed at our very existence and through us at the free world and civilization itself, particularly in light of the times. Query whether you could say that today or imagine having it heard today. Lest there be any doubt that the issues we confront today should not seem new or unfamiliar to us, ask yourself how familiar this summary described by Donovan sounds today. The simple fact was that the colonel and all his belongings were made to disappear from the face of the earth while FBI agents in a counterintelligence function carried out their plan. And ask whether the prosecutor's closing argument resonates in your mind as much with the threat of terrorism today as it clearly resonated for a jury which took 3.5 hours to decide that Abel was guilty, deciding Abel's fate in the shadow of the threat of communism 50 years ago. Colonel Abel's actions, it was said, were directed at our very institutions and through us at the free world and civilization itself. I think our time is well spent learning from our history. Thank you.
Questions? Heinz always has a question.
What happened to Abel? He was convicted. He didn't die in the electric chair. He went to a prison in Alabama. And in 1962, his same lawyer, James Donovan, walked across the Gleinecke Bridge in East Berlin and traded him for Francis Gary Powers. And it was the last time they saw each other.
When you spoke about the bridge, that's what I thought of, but I wanted to confirm. And then what happened after?
Well, Donovan ran and lost for to Abel. Well, actually, what happened to Donovan is much more interesting because he actually went on to a pretty specialized law practice. The next major case he handled was repatriating our would-be revolutionaries in the Bay of Pigs from Castro's Cuba back to the United States. Abel had a sort of sad and dissolute end. He went back to the Soviet Union as a hero, but he was never trusted again for obvious reasons. And he became more or less an ornament at the KGB. He would be trotted out at ceremonial occasions, and it was, for a person as sophisticated and educated as he was, a pretty sad way to end his career. I don't know that we should have that much pity for him, but at one point in his life, he said, if I knew it would have ended this way, I just would have hung myself at the beginning. So.
And how did he escape the death penalty?
Through the savvy lawyering of James Donovan. Donovan argued to the judge, a very elderly judge named Byers in Brooklyn, that someday we're going to have an American spy captured and we ought to have him ready for the exchange. Nobody bought it at the time, but because he had this well-established conservative reputation and he was a U.S. naval commander in reserve and his experience at Nuremberg and with the CIA, they allowed it to happen.
This was 57, you said, right?
So yeah, and convicted in 58.
A few years after Rosenberg, so I'm trying to remember Rosenberg. Mm-hmm. Was there an interplay there?
Well, there might have been. It's never been fully confirmed, but one of the pieces of evidence that was developed at trial was that Abel had instructed Hahnen to go to the Bear Mountain Bridge in upstate New York and bury $5,000. That a woman who was friends with the Rosenberg was supposed to collect his payment. And this was some of the evidence that was used to convict Abel.
Not a pumpkin?
Not a pumpkin. Actually, nothing was ever buried because in cross-examination, Donovan was able to bring out that Hahnen had just stolen the money. In a classically inquisitorial system, it would be a neutral third party, almost like another judge, an investigating judge, you might call him. But in the Russian system, the new system, which is called an adversarial system, the investigator is listed on the side of the prosecutor. So you could say, yes, the prosecutor compiles the case file. And that's what I think makes it such a problem for a would-be adversarial system, because there it sits, one side's case on the judge's desk.
Okay.
What are you as a lawyer to do? On the one hand, you want to have an adversarial trial. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, all the evidence is being compiled in a very inquisitorial style and presented as such.
Okay, thank you.
So would you say, if you look at his trial in the U.S. then and compare it to his trial in Russia today or in the U.S. today, that maybe he got the fairest trial that even though they treated him poorly during the initial, he may have gotten the fairest trial possible in any of those times?
Well, you do have to wonder whether he would have gotten a fairer trial today. There is evidence in both directions. On the one hand, suppose he was treated the way a terrorist suspect is treated today. What do you think? Would he have a fairer trial today or what I described 50 years ago? Might not have a trial. And if he did have a trial, there's a trial going on in the Southern District of New York now, the Galani trial. And there, evidence that was obtained through coercive interrogation was recently thrown out by Judge Kaplan. So there's evidence to say, well, you could have expected a better trial. Another piece of evidence might be a new statute, well, not new anymore, called the Classified Information Protection Act, which deals with how classified information could be used in a particular trial. In Abel's trial, thanks to the Jenks Act and some other investigation, Donovan discovered all sorts of information that would have been highly embarrassing to the United States and also exposed sources and methods involved in a national security intelligence operation. On the one hand, he has a lawyer's duty to zealously defend his client. He should use this to impeach Hahnen and another fellow named Rhodes. But if he did that, his antenna as a naval commander and as a former Nuremberg prosecutor were that this would be very bad for American foreign policy and national security. So what to do? According to the prosecutor, one of the prosecutors is still alive and practicing law in Rochester, New York. He told me it was all settled on a handshake and a gentleman's agreement. They went into the back of the judge's chambers. Donovan expressed his concern, and they agreed, well, don't present 90% of the information, and we'll have the judge instruct the jury that the credibility of these witnesses on certain points has been thrown into doubt, and that the jury should take that into consideration in their deliberations. Now, my first thought was, oh, great, so Donovan's pulling his punches now, because national security is more important than his client's freedom. And we knew that Donovan thinks that Abel is totally guilty. Well, he was totally guilty. But the prosecutor made a good point. He said, you know, sometimes you don't have to go to the bottom of the well to really impeach someone. And the mud that would come up from that well could very well have flecked off on Donovan's client. And so it may have been justified as a more tactical defense decision than choosing sides and not zealously representing his client.
And this is an absolutely wonderful way to think about the comparative method. You tell the story about one process in the US, which is absolutely fascinating, and through that developing a comparative discussion. And I wondered, had you thought about either finding a present case in the Russian context? I mean, there must be Chechen cases, other cases that would be similar to some of the cases going on here, and maybe an older spy case in the Soviet period, and playing those stories together as a larger project.
The first problem which would be an excellent idea is obtaining the evidence, the information. Even the European Court of Human Rights, as you know, when they have these Chechen cases and demand evidence, the case file from the Russians rightly cite their law to say we're not allowed to give you the case file. And so one problem is just obtaining the evidence. And since these Chechen cases often involve allegation that the Article 6 right to a fair trial has been violated by the very fact that there was no investigation, would also complicate finding one of those cases. What also complicates it is that I haven't found that much reception for the idea. I'm delighted that you like it, because the journals that I have floated the idea to have generally said, well, we like the American legal history, but could you cut out the Russia stuff? Which I thought made the piece much too descriptive to want to actually publish. But I'm going to keep trying.
Comparative journals?
One of them.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you think this is a fascinating, but even as a claim for comparative method, it's really interesting. I mean, it's very different to how a lot of comparison gets done, mm-hmm. but it's a lot more interesting.
I'm certainly open to the criticism that it's apples and oranges, and it's a pretty thin read on the strength of Abel's back to compare a 50s-era American criminal law case that is not going to have current criminal law in it. I mean, we didn't have Brady and Giglio back then, versus a contemporary Russian case. But if you buy my...
No, but that's why I was thinking the pairing mm-hmm. of a present-day
right.
American case with a Soviet-era spy case mm-hmm. and a present-era Russian case.
We might be able to do it with Galani. Right.
A quad would be fascinating.
I would have to wait for the Galani trial to end, because I don't think that the habeas cases would really be comparable. And then looking for the Russian case, and maybe even using the European court's materials, if I could get access to the applicants and government's observations in those cases, that would probably be a lot more fodder that I could use. But maybe I'll put it on the back burner for Galani's result.
But there's some earlier cases than Galani. I mean, there's federal cases on some of the earlier terrorism.
Well, we have the Massawi prosecution, which is, you know, not probably the best example. We've got a stack of cases awaiting the military commissions. But again, you know, it might not be the sort of comparison we want.
But there was the initial trade center.
Right, right. But that wasn't the same level of hysteria as today.
That was
not the same level.
And it also didn't have the Patriot Act.
Yeah, that's true.
So, but you know, in the maybe I should start with that and wait for Galani to come down and then add it on.
So one of the things that you talked about was the challenges of introducing adversarialism into Russia. I spent the summer talking to lawyers, and one of the things I was struck by is how criminal lawyers really don't understand or don't think it's part of their job to develop a separate narrative. You know, they're very happy to have, and they think the only thing that their job is to go to court. Mm-hmm. So they kind of fit into this old Soviet story. Isn't that also a challenge of trying to introduce adversarialism?
Yeah, certainly, dealing with the old habits. But whereas the old habits may or may not die out with the people who have been habituated, the code is the code is the code. And so if it retains this case file, one query whether the habit will die out, because it may turn out that what modest success you can have is by working nicely with the state investigator. And two, the European Court of Human Rights disagrees with me. They think that the case file, given the measure of appreciation for Russia's particular circumstances, is compatible with an adversarial system. And since there are case files in Germany and in the Netherlands and in France and elsewhere, and they're all part of the European Convention and also under Article 6, I have not met with a favorable reception to the argument that you can't have a case file. So I've modified it to you can't have a Russian-style case file. And once I learn more about those other systems, I might or might not make a similar claim about them.
I know the story, but it seemed like you compared them at the trial phase. I was curious about the background, right? I mean, the FBI and INS working together in the U.S., I was curious, how would you get to the trial phase in either current Russia or, I mean, in other words, if you think about the inquisitorial aspects of the U.S. system, a lot of them happen at the administrative level, especially in the INS. So I guess I don't know if this helps you with the journal, but just in terms of satisfying somebody like me, wherever that's worth, I was wondering about a more complete comparison, right? Not just simply the trials, but the pre-trial, the administrative things that happen both in the U.S. And so that part was a little bit missing for me.
The article flushes it out a bit more, but maybe not as much as you'd like. Even Justice Scalia has said that the American criminal justice system has its inquisitorial element. The defense attorney doesn't ride along with the prosecutor or the agent. But the difference is that the case file that our agents complete stays in their offices. It never gets to court. Or if it does, it sits on their desk and waits for the witnesses to come in.
Also, the defense does its own investigation, which is fairly uncommon in Russia, right?
And you've got Jenks and Brady and Giglio and lots of other shorthand for Supreme Court cases and statutes that require information that could be used for impeaching witnesses or exculpatory information of use to the defense. Obligating the prosecutor to give those to the defense attorney.
It also strikes me that a lot of the trial happens, a lot of the dynamics of the trial, if you think about it as theater, happen. When you get a very compelling narrative, 2000, I mean, just the whole background that probably got some coverage, or at least that was part of the narrative already, it would be interesting to see how that plays out.
Oh, sure.
No questions?
Just out of curiosity, Gary Powers was the U2 spy plane. Does he receive a trial there, or just falling out of the sky?
He received a trial, but falling out of the sky was pretty bad evidence. That's what we call in a law school bad evidence. You fall out of the sky in the Soviet Union, it's bad evidence. But he did receive a trial.
He did.
Yeah, and it was widely excoriated in the American press as a show trial.
Is there any way to get that? I mean, that would be another fascinating comparison, but I'm guessing that's all closed archives.
I don't know. Alexei, you might have insight into this.
I think it was broadcast a lot of times.
It was old.
Because it embarrassed Eisenhower, because he denied the whole thing.
Right.
Yeah, but to get the case file, that would be in some archive somewhere, maybe.
Right.
Yeah. Although the way in which they protect case files in Russia is not overwhelmingly.
Although even to get the transcript.
Yeah.
of the actual hearing.
Was there pretrial detention in that case? Or
In the Powers case?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was all solitary 2 months.
Oh.
I don't mean pretrial detention. I mean the same level of litigation, but without an attorney or anything.
Widely suspected, but difficult to prove. I think it's widely believed that Powers was interrogated and wasn't given a lawyer in advance. But you know, I don't know the Soviet code at the time, but the Russian code, if you're a witness, you don't have a right to a lawyer, and you don't have a right to refuse to answer questions. If you are labeled a suspect or a defendant or an accused, you have various increasing levels of protection.
But I don't think, I mean, think about Gene Husky's work. I don't think we were allowed to have a lawyer until you were indicted.
I think that's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
So. Which is in keeping with this idea that we wait for the trial. And
well, also in keeping with the idea that we're objective. We're just looking for the mm-hmm. truth. That's
right.
That's the kind of propaganda of the system, right? Mm-hmm. That the procuracy is not really a prosecution. It's just the way of searching for the truth.
I think it would be an interesting research project to see how inquisitorial systems done well preserve this idea and keep cynicism at bay so that we really do believe that the investigator is looking objectively for truth on both sides. And what is it about those systems that keeps them from straying? One thing that I've heard about the success of the Dutch system is that it was predicated initially on a very homogenous small society. And that as Dutch society has become more heterogeneous ethnically and more populated, it's harder to have the same trust in that system. And you also get the normal arguments about institutions and bureaucracies and what they do when they're left to their own devices.
And it was the cases in Germany around the Bundeswaffenschutz. Around the protective group for the Constitution, and in the 1960s, I mean, if you remember the movie The Lost Honor of Katharina Blum, that's about a particular investigation, trial, etc., under that system where it's about terrorism.
Okay.
There's a really interesting.
What's the name of the movie?
Lost Honor of Katharina Blum.
Okay.
I've read the movie, but the book, you know, makes it like the press really.
That, right?
Oh, yeah.
And press played a role as well. Yeah. But who was feeding the
press? It's interesting. At the start of Abel's case, Donovan met with the prosecutor and said, look, I was a Nuremberg attorney, and the whole world's going to be watching this trial. Let's use European criminal procedure rules, and you share all your evidence with me, and I'll share all my evidence with you, and then we'll show the world with the world standards how good American justice can be. And the prosecutor very quickly said, no, we're going to use the federal rules of criminal procedure and the federal rules of evidence. But nice try. Well, thank you very much for your attendance and questions.
Yes, thanks very much. Thank you.